Welcome to Thundercast, Thunder Tech's podcast where we give you our take on what's new in marketing, what's cool, what's lame, and why you should care.
Hey everyone, welcome back into Thunder Tech World Headquarters for another edition of Thundercast. Tom Valentino, communications specialist here, along with creative director Craig Israel.
Hey there.
And we've had a lot of interesting things come up in the world of marketing in the past couple of weeks. So in today's episode, we're going to go around the horn and cover a few of the headlines that have captured our attention. Craig, I'm going to start with you. As our creative director, I'm sure you were pretty interested in the fact that two major international corporations, Google and Verizon, both came out with new logos this week. Can you tell
us? What now? What happened?
Yeah, I know. It happened and it's real. But just for the uninitiated here, can you tell us a little bit about what each of those companies did with their logo and how they look different now?
Yeah, so Google launched their new logo just this week. And there's been a lot of hoopla in the local marketing press about it. If you haven't seen it, which you have, because everybody in the world has seen the Google logo, they've continued their trend to make it a little less whimsical, and now instead of the kind of fun serif font with some thick and thin weights, it's kind of a boring sans serif. It's just there. I find it hard to really work up much passion for it. I'm not outraged they did this. Like I said, Google has been for years making what was a really fun, different logo, much more corporate and kind of boring looking. So this seems to be the natural progression in my mind that now it's pretty generic. I'm sure, as they say, it'll work much better on small screens. So branding-wise, I see why it's a smart move. But it's, like I said, not very exciting.
I was going to say, it feels like they've been making little tweaks to their logo here and there forever. Whether it was messing with a drop shadow on it or beveling on the letters or the angles on the serifs, little things like that that a lot of people might not even notice. But this feels like the most radical change that they've made to their logo that I can remember.
Well, so you're right. The last change before this, I think, is they straightened out the letters a little bit. Google's already always had some dimensionality to it, so the letters kind of look 3D. Now this is a very flat design. But yeah, this is what they've been doing, kind of tweaking with it for years. I will say that I think they launched it in the right way, unlike Yahoo that launched a new logo that they really played up, and then by the time it got out into the public eye, it didn't seem to be that big of an evolution. Google just kind of launched it to people. Most people weren't aware that they were launching a new logo, and then it appeared, and I predict in, I don't know, 6 months to a year, no one will remember what the old Google logo looked like.
Yeah, didn't Yahoo, when they released theirs, was that last year or the year before? And didn't they have like 30 versions that didn't make the cut that they unveiled before that?
They did. They released like one version a day leading up to the new one. And frankly, a lot of the ones they didn't use, I thought were more distinct and more interesting looking than the ones they finally did use.
Yeah, I had the exact same reaction, which is why I thought it was an incredibly dangerous way to go about it. I mean, you have to be incredibly confident and what you're rolling out, I guess, which you should be anyway, of course, but it seems like you're opening yourself up to a lot of unnecessary criticism when you display a bunch of other options that you had and you put them out there for all the world to see.
Yeah, I respect the confidence that they brought to the game, but it clearly didn't pay off for them in the end.
Hmm. Verizon, another one then, a refresh, not kind of similar along the lines of what Google did, where they made some very clear changes, but it was not completely reimagining their brand.
Yeah, unlike the Google logo, which I think is fine, not revolutionary, doesn't really inspire a lot of passion, I think the Verizon logo is terrible.
Right? Really?
I do.
I kind of like it. I'm surprised by this.
Well, it's a move that makes it a little more corporate. Again, I'm sure on smaller screens it looks great, but it had some character in its last iteration. You know, the Z, kind of this red, fell below the baseline, faded out. It had some movement, some excitement to it, kind of interesting to look at. The new logo is literally just a sans serif font with a red check next to it. I don't think a red check, which usually indicates a wrong answer, right, on your test question or just checking the box. I don't see how that really supports the brand.
Interesting. I guess I was okay with it because while I liked what they were going for before with trying to indicate movement, I felt like the gradient on the I don't know what you want to, I don't want to call it a swoosh because that's Nike, but whatever that red mark was before, I felt like the gradient just started to look kind of dated.
It did. I agree with that it was dated looking, but I think there's a lot more interesting visual ways to go where you could have updated the logo without just having this kind of tacked on red check mark next to it.
All right. Fair enough. Another logo making headlines for all the wrong reasons. The Tokyo 2020 Olympics logo that was not unveiled this past week. However, it was scrapped. Why did that happen?
Yeah, so I find this story a lot more interesting than the Google or Verizon logo. So, first we should acknowledge that Olympic logos by and large are terrible. I don't know why, probably just because they're trying to reach a global aesthetic that always seems to fall a little short in my mind, at least to the American audience. So
trying to please everyone and instead you please no one?
Well, yeah, maybe. So Tokyo 2020, they unveiled their logo, I'm not sure, like a year ago. And it falls in line with the kind of terrible Olympic logos I've seen before. If you haven't seen it, it looks like a serif T, except the right limb of the T is replaced with a red dot. And you can read a lot of the overblown rationale of what this means, the red alludes to the Japanese flag. It means heart. It has another serif there on the bottom. So there's a lot of storytelling around it, and it's interesting in that fashion. But the big controversy is that when it was unleashed, almost immediately, there is a Belgium theater group that has a logo that when you look at them side by side, they're extremely similar in construction. And immediately they said, hey, that looks a whole lot like our logo. The Olympic Committee ignored it for a while, but finally it's come to a head, especially since the designer of the 2020 Tokyo logo has recently come under fire for other plagiarism in the marketplace. So,
whoops.
Yeah, not a good day for him. So
no.
Finally the Olympic Committee couldn't ignore it any longer, and they announced that they were scrapping the logo and they're going to start their search anew.
Do you think that that was the right move?
I think so. It wasn't that exciting of a logo to start with, so I don't see a real downside of walking away from it, except for the presumably thousands and thousands of tote bags and T-shirts or whatever that may have already been manufactured with the logo on it. So there's a big financial hit there. But yeah, I think an organization like the Olympics that's besieged by controversy in the best of years, doping, stacking the results, whatever, human rights violations, I don't think they can ignore something like this, that it would just be one more controversy that if they can avoid it well ahead of the Olympics, they probably should.
Do you think there was a legitimate case that this was plagiarized?
Yeah, so that's something we've been talking about internally quite a bit, because you'll see things like this happen time to time. And I should say that probably every designer at some point in their career has had to deal with accusations that they've plagiarized or they've stolen from something else that's then been established. In some cases, it's true, unfortunately. And sometimes you have a case where you have two different designers that just go down the same path and end up with very similar logos. You'll see this all the time in industries that have some very obvious visual motifs, like lawyers, that if you have some sort of scales of justice or gavel in there, or coffee shops that often leverage a steaming cup of coffee or a coffee bean, so that you have two designers that through no fault of their own, working independently, might come up with very similar executions. That happens. In this case, I don't think I believe it. If there was a question about the Olympic rings or something, some obvious visual motif, I might give this guy a break, but it really looks like he was inspired to a big degree by this theater logo that was already out in the marketplace. Should be noted, years before the Olympic logo was revealed. I'm not going to say the guy like traced it, came out and blatantly ripped it off, but it was strongly suggested by this previous work.
Yeah, you're not going to out and out say that he traced it, but I'll tell you what, I mean, just looking at the two of them side by side, if you told me that he did, I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, as soon as I saw the original logo, I said, oh my God, it's incredible how similar they are for that reason. So interesting stuff. And I should also mention quickly here that, Craig, you wrote a blog post about this Olympic logo.
About this very thing, indeed. You should read it at thundertech.com/blog.
That's right. All right. So as our creative director, there was another article I know that hit close to home for you that's making the rounds again, something that was written a few years back. And do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So a couple years ago, this story first came out. There was a designer named Linz Redding, a New Zealand guy, who had a terminal disease, cancer, I believe, and was dying. And he wrote a really impactful article about the advertising and marketing industry, basically saying, as I sit on my deathbed and look back at my career, I don't think it's worth it, that everything I've done has been a con and a sham, and I've wasted my life working in advertising. So when this article first came out, I mean, it really hit the advertising and design community hard because it made a lot of us take a step back and say, you know, is this guy speaking the truth? Because I'll say when I first read it, there's a lot I can relate to. Long hours, clients that aren't satisfied, rounds and rounds of revision, sacrificing, you know, personal life to get the work done. And I've experienced all that. And I agree to a degree that this guy is speaking the truth, that advertising can really consume your entire life, work and private, if you let it. Now, where I draw the distinction is this guy is specifically condemning the advertising world, but I don't think what he's talking about is limited to the ad world, because what he's talking about is letting your job consume your life, and that has nothing to do with advertising. This could apply to doctors or lawyers or plumbers or any career where you don't just stamp a clock 9 to 5. So it applies to advertising, but it applies to all these other industries too. So I take exception there, that I don't think the problems he's talking about are exclusive to our industry. I think it hits a lot of industries. And frankly, I think the biggest problem with this guy, and you know, he died, right? So not to speak ill of the dead, but man, I think he would have been a lot happier at the end of his life. At some point, he would have stepped back and take a look and say, hey, am I happy with what I'm doing, right? Am I getting the most out of life? Because I can tell you, you know, personally, I was at an agency where this was happening to me. You know, my wife and I had just had children. Our girls were still very young, and I was bringing work home every night. And it was expected that you would leave at 5 and you would be back online by 7, and so would everybody else. And we'd be working till regularly towards 9 or 10 o'clock every night. And I wasn't spending as much time with my family as I wanted to. So instead of just writing some bitter essay about it, what I did is I started looking for a new job, because I didn't want to work in a job like that. I didn't want to do what this guy did, you know, 20 years down the road, say, man, I pissed away my life doing this instead of enjoying my family. So I, you know, put out my resumes, and it took a year for me to find a job that was a good fit, that where I could find that work-life balance. But eventually I did, and ultimately I'm happier now.
You know, just compounding the problem, I mean, do you feel that creatively, when you're pounding your head against the wall that much and you're just constantly grinding day after day after day for all those hours? I mean, I would think at some point as a creative professional, that's got to catch up with you, and the work's going to suffer too, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you're taking a work home every night, I don't know if you're doing your best work, right? Some people probably do, right? They're night owls, they'd rather work at night than work in the office. But yeah, if you are under these constant pressures just to churn out work in a never-ending flow, I don't believe you do your best work. I think the best work is done when you have the opportunity to be very thoughtful and really focus on it, not just shove it down the pipeline as fast as you can.
Do you have any tips or tactics that you would share that help you now beyond going and finding a new job or anything that you try to do with your team?
Well, so with my team as creative director, I try to manage a reasonable workload, right? You know, that said, we work in a deadline-driven industry, so there's no getting around it, right? You come from newspapers, Tom, so, I mean, you're familiar that deadlines are deadlines. And, we're not putting out a daily newspaper, but we still are dealing with client deadlines that we have to be respectful for. So I try hard to set up reasonable expectations with our clients of what we can produce and when. And in my personal life, I try to balance that as well, right? Make sure that I'm never overloading myself or my team so that they're set up for failure, that they don't have enough time to do good work unless they take it home or work weekends, because nobody wants that. I can tell you, like here at ThunderTech, my first couple years when I was really, figuring out my new role as creative director, I took work home a lot. But eventually I got to the point where I said, I don't need to do this every night, right? I can get this done right now, or it can wait till tomorrow. And it's not going to be the end of the world, right? Still being respectful of deadlines, et cetera. But yeah, I've taken a really hard look at the workload and say, all right, if this can wait until tomorrow, I'd rather go home and have dinner with my family.
Interesting. All right. Well, we had one more headline that we wanted to cover here today.
Yeah, so let's talk about the something that's not exactly ripped from the headlines, but the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge. So, everybody's familiar with this, presumably, but give us a quick recap, Tom, for the guy who was living in a rock for the past 2 years.
Sure. So last summer, right around this time, if you have a Facebook or Twitter feed, you probably saw quite a few videos popping up with people dumping buckets of ice water on their heads and presumably challenging others to do the same. And the whole idea was, in addition to dumping the ice bucket, the ice cold water on your head, you would also make a donation to the ALS Association. And it was a campaign that really went viral. I think they ended up having about 17 million participants when it was all said and done last year. But it also faced a lot of backlash for being what some people call it an example of slacktivism, where you're doing something, it's a cheap way to feel good, where you're not actually accomplishing anything that makes a real impact.
Yeah, so this is no different than forwarding a Facebook message or something like that, where it doesn't take any real effort or it doesn't necessarily make any real impact on the world.
Yeah, so the idea that a lot of critics had was, okay, so you're dumping a bucket of ice water on your head. How is that helping people with ALS? What was really interesting about this and what makes this timely now is about a week and a half ago, the ALS Association put out an article and an announcement explaining exactly how much money they raised from the campaign and where that money's going. And the good news is, if you are someone who contributed to the Ice Bucket Challenge last year, your money is actually doing some really great things this year. All told, they raised $115 million, and I believe it's 77% of it's going to research, and a good portion of that went into a research project at Johns Hopkins University that led to a real breakthrough in identifying a protein that is damaging cells in ALS patients. And the researchers that are behind this campaign have said that they wouldn't have been able to do this without the contributions from the Ice Bucket Challenge. So It was just really nice to see something like this. It's not just Slacktivism. A campaign that was kind of a feel-good story last year had some real lasting impacts.
So that's what's amazing to me. So something stupid that happened on the internet actually had an impact on the real world. And not just an impact, like a life-altering breakthrough.
Absolutely. And I think it was really great that organization put that message out, because a lot of times there's always that fear of, like, where's my money going when I'm donating to a cause? And you'll see a lot of poorly run charitable organizations that have all their money tied up in bureaucracy, and they're not really funding the cause that they were purported to actually be helping. And this organization here has done a really great job of being accountable. We will share a link with you in the description of the podcast where you can see an infographic breaking down where all the money for this campaign's going.
Yeah, ALS was pretty transparent from the beginning of where this money was going.
Yeah, and I think it's a really good case study for if you're looking to get involved with a campaign like this going forward. I don't know if anybody can just wave their fingers and all of a sudden have 17 million participants getting involved, but I do think it's a really good example of how to do it the right way.
Yeah, pretty cool. Okay, so those are the topics we had for this Thundercast. As always, if you have topics you'd like to hear us discuss, get our take on it, you can email them to us. You can get all the information you need at our website, thundertech.com. As always, if you like this podcast, subscribe. You can find us on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever fine podcasts are sold. And more importantly, if you like it, tell your friends. We would love to have more subscribers. Specifically, you can email the show. We have our own vanity URL or email address, thundercast@thundertech.com, where we will answer your questions, take your suggestions, etc. So until next time, thanks for listening.